You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Tuesday, April 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Graduate Chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, Anthea Butler, also the author of White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. Also on the program today, in the wake of the killing of the unarmed Dante Wright, yet another killing of an unarmed black man just miles from the trial of Derek Chauvin, Minneapolis becomes a militarized zone. U.S. pauses the Johnson & Johnson vaccine deployment to study six instances of blood clots amongst the 7 million doses now administered. CDC, meanwhile, says Michigan could shut down support. NCAA reiterates support for trans athletes. Democratic pollsters acknowledge major errors in their 2020 polling. Really? And lastly, the Biden administration ponders whether to fire the head of the Congressional Budget Office in anticipation of the next reconciliation bill. And lastly, it's just in. Tech workers at the New York Times have announced that they have formed a union and would ask the company to recognize it. And also, the staff of the think tank's Brookings has also formed a union. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Of course, joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing well, Sam. How about you?
I'm doing well. I was quite relieved to see that you did not wear the same color shirt as I. Today being Tuesday, usually we have that problem on Wednesdays, but so I switched it up a little bit.
Yeah, I went with multicolored in order to just cover my bases.
Well done. Very well done. All right, let's get right into it. As of yesterday, we were aware that that Dante Wright had been killed by police in Brooklyn Center, which is a suburb of Minneapolis. And the details weren't quite clear. They have now released body cam footage, which shows the killing of Dante Wright. Ostensibly, the police officer who shot him at near point blank range was under the impression that she was holding her stun gun, or her taser, I should say, and instead shot him dead. There was no indication that there was any type of life-threatening situation here. But really, I mean, what is quite clear from this and what has become like increasingly clear is the practice of police stopping people for traffic violations or not even, or just, you know, in this instance, it was either, it's unclear. I've heard multiple reports regarding either a registration that had lapsed or a air freshener hanging from the car window, the rear view mirror.
regardless. Compelling reasons. I mean, like, it's not like anyone's registrations have lapsed during the pandemic when they can't go to the DMV and air fresheners, God forbid.
But regardless, the point is that there should be the discretion to pull someone over in these instances should be completely gone. It should be there is no pulling them over. If you see from a from your patrol car a lapsed registration, call it in, send a ticket by mail, have that person try and refute it. If you see a violation, call it in. Where they do it now in, you know, you can do it. They do it through cameras. If you're doing, if you can do it through cameras, you can do it through people. You just have the, there's just the value of this to society is minimal. If at all, frankly, these situations are just basically to generate revenue. So let's do it in a touchless manner where there is no point in stopping in these instances, because far too often these things end up with dead people. And for no value to protecting the safety of the community, this is just ends up creating dead people. And very often those dead people are unarmed black men. Here is some protests from Brooklyn Center last night. We should just give you a heads up and a warning. There is there's language that's not safe for work here. This was live on MSNBC last night and did exist. And I think it captures the level of anger. And frankly, how could there not be this level of anger? Play this clip.
On you there, Ron, but there's certain things that we can broadcast and there's certain things that we can't.
Caesar!
Right, are you going to stay out here all night or what's the plan?
I'm going to do what needs to be done.
What's that? What do you just say?
Be here for my people.
Get the police gone from our community.
Be here for my people, however long that takes. Be here for my people.
Sure. Do any of you know Dante and the family very well at all?
No, I've
no. Does anybody?
Get the fuck out! Okay. I don't give a
Rachel. All right, you heard all that. Some of it rational and obviously some of it very angry and passionate. But the bottom line here is that these people are still out here in the street. They're not going anywhere. And the police have stopped firing tear gas. They are still behind that fence perimeter.
Fuck
that's been
police.
Built up. Easy.
Fuck the police!
Fuck the police!
Fuck the police!
Okay. What do you want to see happen?
What do I want to say?
What do you want to see happen?
I want to see... All right.
No, I got it. I got it.
Lock the microphone.
I got it.
I want these bitch-ass niggas stop killing innocent black people. Oh, they want fucking peace! Okay. And that they
Brian, we're going to... We're just going to cut in because we have a responsibility in terms of the language. Okay. And
I think that captures, you know, I mean, frankly, those reactions seem to be completely rational to me. I don't know how else you react to this situation. I mean, this is we're, you know, literally a year out from the killing that started at least this round of protests, and Floyd's dead, and Derek Chauvin is on trial, and then this happens, I don't know, 10 miles away.
Especially because so essentially they pulled him over for dubious reasons, right? And then they found that he had outstanding fines due to two charges, one of them being a marijuana fine, for the total fines being under $400, which caused this situation to escalate to the point where the officer felt the need to pull out what she thought was her taser. But even so, based on just the little and the complete... innocuous nature of the crime here, which the idea that marijuana fines are a crime at all.
Well, they're all misdemeanors. It doesn't even matter what it is. It doesn't even matter. They're misdemeanors.
I understand. It's just, it's such an inflection point of so many things. As you mentioned, we're approaching the 1 year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. This is 15 minutes away from where George Floyd was murdered. You know, we're talking about reparations and decriminalization of marijuana nationwide as more states move to make it legal. And how do we do that in a responsible way that recognizes the harm that marijuana prohibition has caused on communities of color? And all of these things are just coalescing to this like darkly poetic moment, which resulted in the death of yet another Black man, yet another Black man. And, you know, Biden's first response, I don't want to see looting in the streets. You know, what do you expect when the harm has been done over and over again? And so, you know, we keep trying to paper over this by just white politicians, Democrats like Joe Biden, particularly saying, you know, no looting in the streets. Let's be old school about this, you know, law and order, et cetera. We're past that. This is a point where we need to actually repair the harm, or else this is going to keep happening. And I can't, it's like the frustration is palpable. And of course, it's like fear, imbued with fear for communities of color in so many ways and decades of this.
I mean, it seems pretty straightforward to just, at the very least, you just stop the traffic stops. That's the first thing to start. It's just, this is the low hanging fruit, folks. Just, you know, we just need to continually lop off functions of the police department that are not there, but for, you know, essentially harassment and fishing expeditions, because this is the way they end up.
And sorry, just really quickly, when was Oscar Grant murdered? Do we know, at Fruitvale Station? It was the same story. Cop thought it was a taser. Another man, like. There's so, even the minute details of this, even the very specific details are repeated details. That's how frequent this is.
Yep. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back with Anitha and Thea Butler. She is the author of White Evangelical Racism: The Politics of Morality in America. We'll be back in just a moment. Today's show is sponsored by we got a couple of sponsors today, today's show sponsored by Blinkist. It makes it much easier for you to sit down and learn stuff either by reading or by listening. Blinkist is for anyone who cares about learning, doesn't have a lot of time. Blinkist takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, gather them together in 15-minute text and audio explainers, or blinks. Use the blinks to get into a topic quickly. You can find new topics to grow from, figure out which books you want to spend more time reading or listening to more deeply. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcast creators to blink those for you too, so you can get to the heart of an episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge. 27 nonfiction categories like self-improvement, management, mindfulness, and more. Folks, I've talked about Blinkist quite a bit, and I use it quite a bit as well. I think I got like two or three different categories the way I use it. One is those books that are sort of how-to that I may not be interested in reading, but I could use the help. Maybe in just like learning how to be more friendly, or, you know, the 80-20 concepts in business, that type of stuff. But I'm not going to read the whole book, but I want the key takeaways. And then there's other books that I'm not that interested in reading, but I feel like I need to know them. You know, I went through that with like, you know, Blowout by Rachel Maddow. Wanted to. You know, that's it's not necessarily one that I was going to read, or that Rick Wilson thing, Everything Trump Touches Dies. Like, I wasn't going to read the full Rick Wilson book. I knew what that guy was about, but I was just curious, like, what's he saying? But then you can also, there are things like, maybe this is a book I want to read, and it can lead you to that in that way. The same thing with the Blinkist Shortcast. You can quickly catch up on podcast episodes you've missed. Now, right now, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience. You go to Blinkist.com/Majority Report, start your free 7-day trial, and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Majority Report, and get 25% off and a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/Majority Report. Oh, this is a good one. This is one of those sponsors that I was using, and then they just coincidentally became a sponsor of the show. Folks know I have an affinity for apple trees. Where do I get my apple trees? Well, do I want them to produce in 12 years or in a couple? I get them at fastgrowingtrees.com. The fact is their trees are not necessarily faster growing, but they ship you trees that are fully formed, not massive ones, you know, like 3, 4 feet, 5 feet you can get. Skip the big box stores. Head to fastgrowingtrees.com. They are the world's largest online nursery. It's a better way to buy trees, shrubs, and plants for your home and yard. It's fastgrowingtrees.com. You don't have to wait in lines. You don't have to mess up your car. You don't get a lackluster selection. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com. You choose from thousands of varieties, trees, shrubs, plants. They're expertly curated to thrive in your area. You just, you know, you make sure you know what your growing zone is. Doesn't matter what you're looking for. Fruit trees, privacy trees, shade trees, added color for your yard. Every plant is shipped with a well-developed root system ready to explode with new growth. That is the key. You're not going to, none of these things are going to die on you. You're going to, they're already, this year I got a bunch of like tall grass things. I've gotten the bloomerang tree in the past. I've gotten Korean pear trees. And of course, a couple of Arkansas black apple trees, and all of them thriving. Now through June 30th, go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority report. Get 15% off. That's 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. Fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. I wish I had known about that 15% because I got those grass things without waiting for, I didn't realize.
Can you be more specific about grass things?
It's not marijuana. They don't sell that.
I understand.
Tall grass. I don't know what else to say.
Okay.
Oh, and Mother's Day is coming up. And if there's ever been a year to make the moms in your life feel loved and appreciated on Mother's Day, this is the one. People have been dealing with a lot of distance. That's hard. You can honor the special woman in your life with a heartfelt, sentimental gift the whole family can cherish forever. That's Storyworth. Storyworth is an online service. It helps every mother figure in your life share stories through thought-provoking questions about their memories and personal thoughts. It's a great way to engage with them, especially if you can't be in person together. It's also just a great gift for the entire family, your kids or your brothers and sisters. To get the stories of your parents' life or your grandparents' life, what could be better? What they do is each week they email a different story prompt. It's a question that you wouldn't think to ask or you wouldn't think that would provide much, but they do. You know, what was your favorite car? Where was the first time that, you know, you went on a date? I mean, all sorts of different things that you wouldn't even contemplate asking. And somehow it's just easier when it's done sort of like through a third party, and it provokes people to start telling stories. And then after 1 year, Storyworth will compile all of your mom's stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped for free. This is a great way to stay in touch and to keep those stories alive. And now is do not dally on this. I can take it from my personal experience is not something you want to dilly-dally about. A great way to just sort of like stay in touch with your folks. It's also just, you know, on a weekly basis, a good conversation piece. Frankly, I've been thinking about just getting it for myself so that I'm doing it for my kids. But right now, you can give your mom the most meaningful gift this Mother's Day with Storyworth. Get started right away. No shipping required by going to storyworth.com/majority. You get $10 off your first purchase. That's storyworth.com/majority for $10 off. Okay, I want to welcome to the program Anthea Butler. She is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Graduate Chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also the author of White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. Anthea, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sam. Glad to be here.
I'm here, of course, with Emma Vigeland as well.
I am.
Your book is incredibly timely. I mean, both sort of like in a broader sense in terms of this era and particularly now when we have, you know, just sort of just more, I guess, maybe some of the most explicit, you know, forms that we can see in our modern era of racism, another unarmed black man being shot by police. Then maybe we can circle back around to that. But the I want to get into your book. I think it's fascinating, and it's something, you know, like I have sort of nibbled around on the edges, but you are coming from an evangelical background. I mean, it just set the table for us on that, and also just be, you know, I'll try and remind you during this conversation, but like I don't know the taxonomy, frankly, of different Christian, practices and whatnot. So at any time that you can add some of that, that would be helpful.
Okay, I will try. The taxonomy is this. I'll tell the short story. The short story is I did not come into evangelicalism because of birth. I came in it because of accident. Somebody invited me to go to church when I was in my 20s and became that and went to an evangelical seminary, actually Fuller Seminary, which is the biggest evangelical seminary in the country. And that's where I got my first introduction for evangelicalism. And for me, it was, you know, part of a good experience, and then it started not to be such a good experience. I think in part because there were all these sorts of rules and things about, you know, whether you could have sex or not, whether you could, you know, how you voted. And I should say that this was a time period in part of the book where two big things had happened. One was the Rodney King trial, and the other was basically the sort of racial reconciliation things that were happening all of the time, right? In terms of evangelical churches. So it was an interesting time to be looking at race. And so when I finished my PhD and realized that I was sort of cycling out of that religious tradition, I often thought about the ways in which it looked that evangelical was one always associated with white, when we talk about that in the public and especially for politics. And then secondarily, how most of the cultural things and some of the theology is coded as white. And so while you have Black and Asian and Latinx evangelicals who would believe some of the same kind of Christian beliefs, right? They are not considered to be evangelical because they're not white Republican voters. And I think that's part of the core of why I wrote the book, because I felt like two things. One was that morality was being used as a shield, as a power grab politically. And secondarily, the ways in which that morality is always coded is through, you know, the family, i.e. the white family, and everybody else isn't, you know, subservient to that. And that's probably a bad word, but I think that's also a true word and how to describe it.
So, I mean, for those of us who don't know, like, what constitutes an evangelical? Like, how is, like, when you decide to join the evangelical church, what are you signing up for, both, like, I guess, theologically, mm-hmm. and maybe in terms of practice.
Yeah, practice and culture. Okay, so what you're signing up for basically is you have a belief in Jesus Christ, or what people would call the Bebington Quadrilateral. It means that you want to be mission minded. You believe in the in Scripture. You believe that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, you know, quote unquote, right? And that you have a commitment to spreading the gospel. So if we take the word evangelical in Greek, it just means, you know, spreading good news, evangelion, right? And then the second thing you're signing up for is a host of practices. And those practices may be, you know, regular church attendance, Bible study, learning scriptures. It also means some cultural things. You might be, you know, asked to dress a certain way. You might ask to be, you know, not watch secular kinds of things like television or even listening to the Majority Report, right? You might want to listen to some other kind of programming that is more Christian minded. And so I, you know, there's a evangelical author, George Marsden, who said an evangelical is anyone who likes Billy Graham. I would probably reframe that because it was an old way of thinking about it. I would probably say now an evangelical is probably anybody who voted for Donald Trump right now, unfortunately. But, you know, because a lot of evangelicals have found themselves alienated from the MAGA kind of style of Trumpism. So I think maybe that's a better, you know, 2021 way to talk about evangelicalism because it's been so politically focused in these last 30 or 40 years.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Emma.
Yeah, no, but part of what I think gives them credence to I guess behave with this entitlement, at least white evangelicals, right, is that this concept of performing morality, which yes. gives them this kind of authority, which you touch on. Can you talk about that concept in terms of their political power and cultural power?
Sure, absolutely, because I think that's a really important part of the book, Emma. One of the things that I think is really important about this performance of morality is that they can say, well, we believe in marriage, we believe in same-sex marriage, we believe in the family, we believe that, you know, abortion is a sin and that we are pro-life. And those kinds of issues are the issues that they forefront. Now, let me give you kind of a little quick history here, because I think this is really important and I want to use it as an arc. Back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan, you know, was divorced, but evangelicals voted for him anyway because they said they were for him, right? We get to 2016, it doesn't matter that Donald Trump has been married 3 times and divorced and had that little Hollywood, you know, thing that happened with about grabbing things, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't matter to them. And so what I'm really interested in is the fact that for evangelicals, morality used to be a very important part of how they thought about first themselves, secondarily their religious leaders, and third, the political leaders. But now we get to 2016 and 2021, and it's like, oh, that's out the window now. We just need a guy who's going to give us what we want. And so I think what we've seen is sort of a declension in the ways in which they use morality, first of all, even though at the same time, I would say the biggest moral issue right now that they still really cling on to is about abortion. I think that's never going to go away. Pro-life is never going away with evangelicals.
All right, so let's go back to the origins, and so that we can see that arc of the sort of jettisoning of morality as as morality as opposed to really, I mean, in many respects, a justification for political action. I mean, I don't know how else to express that, so let's go back to the foundations. And as you write, racism is not a bug in the context of evangelicism. It is a feature. Let's talk about the foundations of that racism in evangelicalism. And this goes back, you start your book this way, in the 1800s.
Yeah, I do. And I started with slavery because there's a narrative about how evangelicals like to tell their story. They like to tell it like, we were abolitionists. We were, you know, we did missionary work. We did all of these good things. But, you know, the fact is that they were also slaveholders. And there were also people who believed that, you know, people of African descent were inferior, both, you know, morally and physically and mentally. And so what I'm showing at the beginning of the book is how these ideas about slavery, which were hinged in scripture, whether we're talking about the curse of Ham or the curse of Cain or, you know, or polygenesis, this dual creation where they thought that Black people were the aberration creation and that white people were actually the true creation created of God, right? And from God. I think these kinds of issues in slavery were really important in terms of forming certain kinds of evangelical ideas. And so when we look from slavery on forward, and also to think about the ways in which churches broke up, and then we have sort of this, you know, focus in on the lost cause, right? Where you get a kind of idea about what, you know, white women in the family are supposed to look like vis-a-vis other families, you can start to see where this moral foundation starts. And then you bring that up to the 20th century.
Well, and so, I mean, so help me through this. I mean, mm-hmm. presumably, just about everybody, all the white people in the United States, I shouldn't say all the white people, but I mean, certainly the vast majority, there were abolitionist movements, and you referred to this as the white savior, sort of, I guess, a notion in which evangelicals are trying to present themselves at that point. And so the real issue is, how much was the evangelicism used to justify slavery? I mean, other people could find it in other ways that they would justify the slavery.
Yeah.
But what work did evangelicism do to justify slavery, and how integral was that at that time?
I mean, it's very integral. If we think about it, it's about the Bible, essentially. And I mean, I think one of the things that I'm always trying to talk to my students and people who don't know this history is that you can't think about this like everybody's got a Bible in their hand. Most people don't. They're hearing this from preachers. They're hearing it from other people. So these ideas get put forward orally. It's not just about how you read them or whatever. And a lot of this has to do with preaching. Who's saying what? How are they saying it? So let me give you an example of somebody that I think is really important. George Whitefield is known as a great, evangelist and missionary, right? But most people don't know that he held slaves. And he used the money that he made from slave labor to fund all his orphanages and everything else. I mean, this is George Whitefield. There's a statue of him on my campus. You know, they're going to take it down. But there's a statue of it on Penn's campus. And so I think when we start to think about, you know, slavery, we have to think about what are people doing during this time period who would be termed evangelicals, who are part of a great evangelical history. It is not to say that all evangelicals were for slavery, but it is to say that evangelicals have written a certain kind of story about themselves that has left this foundational story out. And I'm here to kind of help get them back on track and make them realize this is part of your foundational story. Just as much as you believe that, you know, that you were here to save the poor benighted slaves and, you know, people around the world and all of this other stuff through missionary work, you also were part of slavery. You were part of, you know, positioning yourselves in a way that promoted these things. And some of these same ideas come forward to the 20th century and to the political and social realm.
There is this quality of everybody was like, how could the evangelicals support Donald Trump? I mean, as we were saying, like, this seems completely out of character. And I think, and if I understand, the point of the book is to say, like, no, this has already been embedded in your character. And it's just that, that the historiography has obscured this. But is it that, is there something specific that evangelicism, maybe, am I saying that right?
Evangelicalism.
Is it built upon a white supremacy, or is it just far more tolerant of than evangelicals will have liked to have told themselves?
I would say both and. I would say it's far more tolerant, first of all, but, you know, we have to deal with the history of this country. I mean, there's been all kinds of conversations about things like the 1619 Project versus the 1776 Project. How do we teach these things? And I think one of the, you know, tragedies of teaching right now in America is that people just don't know the history. I mean, one of the reasons why I did this book was like, I'm just writing history. This is straight up stuff. Everything you can prove, there's nothing different about this. And I think for evangelicals, especially, the marriage of their history, a religious history, this Christian history, with a narrative about America. America is a Christian nation. America is, you know, is here to protect the world. These kinds of stories that evangelicals have told themselves and have told the rest of us, right, about what this history and narrative is, I think it's really important to step back and say, that's not all of the history. You're not telling the whole story. You have to think about what the story has been like and how it has been affected you. And so that's why I think for me, it was important to write this book at this time, because you might be tempted to just throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, this is because of Trump and they just like Trump because he's going to give them justices and everything else. But it's not Trump. I mean, Trump is kind of like the end of this. He's not the end of the story, but he's kind of like this point in this, in a long story that has gone on about, you know, political action and power and how it's, you know, how it's gained through religion and religious means.
You mentioned Ronald Reagan earlier, and it just, I always return to the fact that he started Martin Luther King Day, right? In order to just kind of sap it, in my view, of the real activism and the heart behind the civil rights movement. And Billy Graham, who you mentioned earlier, you know, he appeared with Martin Luther King, but at the same time didn't support civil rights. Was there some of that quality in what you're talking about here, where the performance of morality and even kind of throwing Chum out to the civil rights movement in order to keep up that appearance of morality just upheld the white supremacy that was underpinning evangelicism, as you say, for so many decades?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, part of it is about, you know, how do you make the appearances versus what the reality is, right? And so this performance that I've talked about is about how do we make this clean? So, you know, Reagan may put this up and the states fight this, you know, famously John McCain was one of the people who was against having, you know, Martin Luther King Day, right? Or we can think about, there's a great picture in the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C., that has a tableau from the 20th century of one side is Billy Graham and the other side is Martin Luther King. And the first time I saw it, I started laughing because I was like, y'all are putting them together like they were best buddies, but this is not the case. You know, they're not best buddies. And, you know, there's a moment in which they're together in 1956 when he does his, you know, rally at Madison Square Garden where he prays before Billy Graham comes on. But after that, he's very, you know, Billy Graham is very critical of the civil rights movement because he doesn't think that this can happen. He actually says, you know, I don't think that little black boys and little white girls and, you know, everybody not going to be together till they get to heaven. And I think that's a pretty big statement about where he thinks this is going to go. But then he has to change his mind when it doesn't go there, right? So I think that, you know, whether we're talking about Reagan or we're talking about Billy Graham or we're talking about especially the ways in which these racial reconciliation things that the Southern Baptists or Pentecostals or, you know, Promise Keepers that I talk about in the book have happened, I think there are sincere people in the middle of this, right? But there's one key thing that always is important. The issue for evangelicals is individual sin. And so it's like if you and I were talking and, you know, you said to me, and I'm not saying this is you, Emma, but if you said to me, I feel like I'm racist, and I would say, well, Emma, you know, I really know that you're not and that God's going to forgive you of that or whatever, that's individual, right? But they don't see the structural kinds of racism, nor do they see the structural kinds of issues that are there about white supremacy and the ways in which that continues to perpetuate itself. So there's two different conversations that are being had. And what I'm trying to do is get people to understand what the structures are underneath this, how they think about it, and how maybe they can take a step back for a moment and think about what has happened to their movement because of it.
But what is it? I mean, why do they want to sort of like obscure? I mean, like where, like when you take, let's say, the Lost Cause and you take a Bill Graham saying, you know, sort of like projecting that he's for civil rights and the elements of the racial reconciliation programs that, you know, some of which were sincere and others which were like, this is an important thing for us to project. Like, what is the importance of that projection? Is there a theological grounding for it, or is the fact that it's, you know, like, I don't know how you, I mean, like if you have a deep abiding belief in the existence of God, how do you think you're going to get away with that anyways?
Well, if unless you think God is white, you can get away with it, right? Well, so I mean, let's start there. Okay, so But I mean, seriously, I think I take your question very seriously. And I think part of it is about politeness. It's like a sense in which, you know, Christianity, you're supposed to love your brother, love one another and all this stuff. And so what you hear people say is that, well, of course I love my Christian Black brother or sister, or my, you know, my Mexican brother or sister or whoever, right? I'm not a racist. It, you know, you hear this all the time, right? You can see it, you know, happening in social media and everything. But when we start to deal with the structural issues about racism, you know, and the ways in which the structures of racism have hurt other people, whether we're talking about education or economics and all this stuff, what it invariably comes back to is that, well, you know, people have made individual choices. And if you would just pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all this stuff. And so there's a narrative that's not just a religious one. And I think this is really important for you and listeners to understand, is that these kinds of Christianity gets mixed up with ideas about Americanism and individualism and capitalism, and they play out in certain kinds of ways. And I see them playing out this way in evangelicalism, so that where, you know, in the 19th century, you would think, well, we're supposed to take care of the poor and everything else. By the 21st century, it's like, well, those people don't need healthcare. They don't need this because they're not working. God's not blessing them. And this is the transformation of a movement that used to care about these things to a movement that thinks that people who don't have health care or people who are broke or people who are poor don't deserve to be taken care of because that's their individual problem.
Was that transformation, when did that take place? Was that essentially over, like during the Carter era? And the moral majority when you're Bob Jones yep. was losing its yep. tax status. Okay. Tell us about that, because so I want you to fill that in, but just so that I can keep track of where we are, there is this sort of existence of this malignancy within evangelicalism that they had kidded themselves on some level by that didn't exist. And basically it's almost like a dormant allergy, and the context was right for this allergy to come out. And that was in the late 70s or early mid 70s, I guess.
Yeah, let's say the allergy was there, but the allergy was buttressed by the fact that you had white leadership and white patriarchal leadership. I want to make that really clear. This is about, you know, men. It's not, you know, women play a part in this too, but they don't have power. But what happens in the 70s is a couple of things. And so the normal story where you would think about evangelicals being involved in the political is that, oh, it's about, you know, Roe versus Wade. And that happened. Well, that's only a small part of it. The bigger part that brings people together is actually Bob Jones University and Bob Jones being forced to integrate or else lose their tax status. And Bob Jones University won't do it. They lose their tax status. This is a very simplification of the story, but that's really helpful. Why does this affect evangelicals so much? Well, because they had put together lots of Christian academies, or what people, you know, used to call segregation academies, that said, well, we're Christian, so we don't have to let everybody in. We can do this post Brown versus Board, you know, 1954, right? And so we still have white schools, but they're just Christian schools. And this threatened the tax stat, you know, the tax exempt status of all of these schools. And so this was the thing, the organizing force that brings together all of these people to bring the moral majority. It also is a moment, which I think is really important to say, given what we're dealing with right now, a moment where people begin to realize the power of evangelical votes. And so Paul Weyrich, who was actually a Catholic, who brings this in, says, we don't want everybody to vote. You think about good government, we don't want that. We need to make sure that everybody doesn't vote because we want to make sure we hold on to power. And in that moment, you know, alongside of, you know, Jerry Falwell and the moral majority and all these forces that come together, that you see the ascension of Ronald Reagan, who actually doesn't do as much as you would think for evangelicals, but he really does solidify a way in which they believe that they can have political power. If you want to think about somebody who actually is probably an even more important actor in this show that doesn't get a lot of press, it's Pat Robertson. Because Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition, you know, begins in, you know, 89 after he loses. And when they understand that they could give voting guides to people at churches and tell them, take this into the polling booth. You can vote the way that we tell you to vote for people who are Christian candidates or evangelical kind of candidates, then that becomes a more serious effort in which to how to bring those voters together so that when you finally get who I like to call the real evangelical president, not Donald Trump, but George W. Bush, that coalition is solid and brings in somebody who, you know, is for compassionate conservatism, but still plays the same old tricks that everybody else is playing all the time in the Republican Party.
Pat Robertson still broadcasting.
Yeah, still broadcasting. Barely.
That he ran for president. I mean, I don't know if people recall that. And so that confluence. I mean, because this move into politics, essentially, right? I mean, this is the moment where the concept of leave unto Caesar that which is Caesar's goes out the window. And it is done. I mean, let's be clear. It's done to protect segregation. Right.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
You know, it's like we're going to lose our tax exempt status. Well, OK, you can keep your tax exempt status. You just have to not have a segregated school. Oh, yes. Well, wait a second. No,
no,
that's a bridge too far.
Yeah.
And so this is and at that point, it's almost as if there was like the floodgates opened and it was like, OK, now that sort of we've been laid bare, we might as well just go all in. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this morality of evangelicalism becomes highly malleable and really just more of like a form of virtue signaling and a list of identity. Like it's just an identity at that point that can you can roll other things in at any given time. At one point, I feel like the deficit was rolled into this.
Yes, it was. But again, the deficit was rolled into it as a way to pretend like, you know, Christians are frugal. Christians know how to take care of their money. And if the government doesn't know how to take care of money, then that means that God does, you know, God's not with us. And we need to make sure that we're not being wasteful on those people who need stuff because they're not really working that hard. They should be working, you know, so it's all of a piece, right? And it can be very hard on the outside to see this, but I think it's really important to understand that even in the case of Bob Jones, you know, when do they get their tax exempt status back? Early 2000s, I believe it's 2001, 2002. So, I mean, this is how long this thing lasts. And that's really important to understand that people dig their heels in. They don't want to do this. And you might say, well, that's really crazy. Why would they want to be that way? Well, because there's not been any penalty for it, as we can see through the Trump administration, where they've had, you know, Trump has given them lots of judges and three Supreme Court judges. And that plays into what has, you know, traditionally been a part of the Republican Party, this conservatism. But now I would say that what has happened is that I used to say that the evangelicals were embedded in the Republican Party. But now I think Republicans are now embedded in evangelicalism and they're working for them instead of working for the party in certain kinds of ways that, you know, people in the past would have thought, like Buckley and others would have thought what, you know, conservatism really look like.
Yeah, I'm going to take a bit of a pivot here just because Q is on my mind. I just watched that HBO documentary. I just wanted to ask you what you think about the overlap with the QAnon movement. Because there's a lot of similarities, even though ostensibly the goals of QAnon don't entirely overlap with what, you know, religious texts have to offer.
Yeah, I think the thing about Q is that what Q plays into is something very important about evangelicals, which is there's always a sense of fatalism, of fear, of that things are going to come crashing down and that they have to be the ones culturally to uphold the nation and that at any moment we're going to be destroyed from inside by certain kinds of forces. And so I think this is what's been very attractive for evangelicals about Q. And I think what's also important about this is that whether you think about it like Q or Christian nationalism or whatever, there's these tangents that are religiously inflected in evangelicalism about biblical belief that sort of help evangelicals take an easier road into something like Q or the kinds of nationalism things that we saw on January 6th about, like, you know, praying in the Capitol and all of this stuff, that God wants to bring something new. And Q really plays into a lot of that kind of conspiracy theory thinking slash, you know, this is the end times. What are we going to do? And also, and never discount this, you know, the ways in which evangelicals think about themselves as a persecuted minority.
It just basically trains the mind, right? To have that sort of the shape of your thoughts. Q fits right into that that construct. Yeah. I mean, so what? I mean, if the Republican Party is now beholden to this, I mean, it's almost, we're almost at the point where it's not, it's not even beholden. It's just become one thing at this mm-hmm. point, where and it really is, it feels like a modality of thought because you don't hear anything about the deficit anymore. It doesn't have any resonance. I mean, it's guns is still like, seems to me to be a religious tenet almost. You know, at one point it was, you know, that the ACA was too long and that was un-American and that was un-Christian on some level. These things all get blended in. Mm-hmm. What, like, has it broken? Like, what is, like, when, I mean, has the fever broken, but I mean, has the mechanism broken? Like, at one point it doesn't have more to consume and it starts to consume itself.
I think we're at the consume itself stage, because I think that there's nothing to talk about. I will say, you know, you brought up the deficit. I think the only way they talk about the deficit now is that we're spending too much money to get rid of coronavirus, which they don't believe in the first place. Right.
Right.
So,
and vaccinations, I mean, this whole vaccinations, thing.
For you're like going, I don't understand. And I'm going, well, it's because they don't like to think about science. Science is not, you know, the end all be all. It's God's going to take care of us, right? And but God is not going to help you breathe when they stick that, you know, that ventilator inside of you. If you go get the vaccine, that's a lot easier than spending all this time in the hospital and maybe seeing your loved one die, unfortunately. And I think that this way in which, you know, the Republican Party has left off all of the things they would have been caring about, you know, fiscal conservatism, limited government, all of this stuff. They didn't have any complaints when it was Trump doing this, you know, when he ran up the deficit, right? But the moment it happens with somebody else, they do. But at the same time, they're besieged and beset by all of the conspiracy theories they've got to deal with right now, right? So it's about, you know, we're not going to wear masks, or Republican governors letting this go, or that, you know, January 6th wasn't as bad as it was, or, you know, any of the myriad other things like immigration and all of these issues, which all have some, you know, I would say linkage to what evangelicals believe, right? But now they have become so hardened that they can't move out of these, you know, really extreme positions that they are in. So this is where I think we're at a very critical stage, because these, you know, positions have made them not to be able to move. And then secondarily also have put them in a space where everything they say now sounds more like religion than it does about a political stance.
So, I mean, if the Republicans, so this is, I mean, from my perspective, like the Republicans can't even sort of muster up. So they went through the same thing with the deficit, right? I mean, that was like ostensibly like their theology and they completely threw it over. And it really just sort of laid bare the fact that it was never really, they never really believed that theology. It was really more just signifying.
Yeah.
And now they can't pivot back to it. You know, I mean, they tried to. Even when they're talking about, when they were talking about the relief bill, it was, well, I mean, they didn't say anything about the deficit, really. I mean, it was just like, this is too big and it's unnecessary. And then even when they talk about the infrastructure bill, they're not even talking about it in terms of the deficit. They're saying, they're haggling over the word infrastructure and they're just deploying like wish list. But I guess my point is that They broke their, whatever it was, their signifying. They broke it. It's just like it was a veneer that has shattered, and they don't seem to be able to sort of like glue it back together. Did Trump do that to evangelicals, like in terms of their morality in some level?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he in a way he pushed them to the point where they had to accept everything to accept him. Do you see what I'm saying? And so in that sense, yes, he broke it. But I think it was already broken because they were at the point, and I think the crucial point is 2015 when same-sex marriage becomes the law of the land. I mean, I'm forgetting my years. I might have the year wrong. But when Obergefell happens, it's basically a moment where they're like, we just lost the biggest thing we could lose. You know, now gays can get married. What are we going to do? How do we get this back? And so I think the prize has always been at the end, can we get rid of Roe versus Wade? And so it became important to get those judges and to get that in place so that that could fall. That was the, you know, we couldn't stop this, but we can stop this. And we can stop this by getting the judges. And so, yes, he broke them in a way. But I think the whole thing is broken because the ways in which both the Republican Party and evangelicals have acted is that the theologies have hardened or the beliefs have hardened so much to where they're now, you know, you could almost call them fundamentalists in a way because they can't come off of any other line. It's all about, you know, this is what we believe and that's it. It's sort of like, you know, Mitch McConnell saying corporate people need to stay out of politics about the, you know, voting, right? But I'm like, dude, they give you money. Why are you talking to them like this? And he tried to backtrack it a little bit. But at the same time, he had to realize that his hard line about no, 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 no has backed them into a corner where they can't do anything else.
And I guess, I mean, the veneer that I'm thinking about in terms of being broken is really one is on the perception side that like there has been a privileging of evangelical thought that existed for a long time. I mean, people forget this, but Hillary Clinton back in the early aughts was like, we need to maybe move a couple of steps in the direction of evangelicals when it comes to abortion, for instance, because they have real heartfelt beliefs and et cetera, et cetera. And they obviously have morality on their side, et cetera, et cetera. And it feels like nobody actually buys that anymore of the people who would have 25 years ago, let's say. And that's the veneer I'm talking about being shattered. It's no longer, nobody believes it anymore. You know, whether they believe it anymore, the evangelicals believe it or not, is irrelevant as much as nobody believes that they believe it anymore.
Exactly. And that's part of what I was trying to get them to see with this book is that people believe some things about you. And one of those big things is racism. And here's the history of that. And as much as you like to say that this is not you, this is you, you know, or the thing that everybody says on Twitter, this you, right? And it's sort of like, yeah, nobody believes them anymore because we've seen all the things, whether you want to bring it down to a basic level to talk about, you know, the people who have failed like Jerry Falwell Jr. or Ted Haggard or any of that stuff, we know that they weren't holding up morality, right? I mean, and so there's one way to look at it, but there's the other ways in which, you know, Franklin Graham has spoken about whether that was Obama or, you know, denigrated other people and denigrated Black Lives Matter and denigrated all of these things. We know that it's not just about rhetoric, it's about their belief. And we know that they don't believe the things that they've told us that they believe because they don't uphold them themselves. So why should we believe them? And why should we take them at their word about anything? And so maybe the bigger thing that I think you're signaling to here is that we've all been caught up in this way in which evangelicals have, you know, sort of, I would say, trained all of us in the media and in scholarship and everything else to think about them as moral actors, when the reality is that they are not moral actors. They are actors who want power and use morality to get it.
Or the appearance of morality.
Go on, Sam.
Yeah. Where does this head? Like where, I mean, I know this is probably outside your portfolio as a historian, but where does this lead 10, 15, 20 years down the road? I mean, if we were talking contemporaneously at the time that like, hey, they're starting this moral majority, you know, in the 70s, and they're fighting this and they're starting to make a case of abortion, we could have maybe made some prediction about where this is going to lead. But it sort of feels like we're at the end of that epoch. And so the question becomes, what does the next epoch look like?
That's a good question. I think there's two ways. One is that this collapses because of age and demographics. that could be one way, and that this is not, this does not become the power group that we think it's going to be. Or B, which is the more frightening aspect, is that depending on what happens in 2022 and 2024 elections, that there's even increased hardening, and then we move into this kind of, you know, neo-fascist kind of state that is, you know, run by, you know, religious actors, right? And circumscribed by that. I mean, I think we're at an interesting moment where I don't know how it's going to go, I'll be honest with you, but it could go either one of these two ways. And I think that that's really important to think about, because I think, you know, I'll say this, January 6th was the biggest warning bell that this country could ever get. And in part because what people didn't see about January 6th is that it was supported by churches long before January the 6th. There were lots of churches talking about there were going to be a reckoning. And if you think about the lies that were told about the election, the lies that were told about Biden's win and that Donald Trump had really won, and how readily people believed that, and how churches primed people to be ready to take over on January the 6th, I am not sure that that won't happen again. Because we have these kinds of religious actors and people who feel that they're very patriotic and in certain kinds of ways that none of us who believe in this nation would think are patriotic, will do this kind of activity again because they have religious fervor.
I just want to remind everybody, the most powerful theocrat in the history of the United States in terms of where they attained elected office was a guy named Mike Pence. Anthea Butler, the book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll wrap this thing up. It is it's interesting to contemplate where we'll be in 15, 20 years with this. But, you know, people should keep in mind that the Republicans have a structural advantage in these elections, both from a congressional standpoint because of gerrymandering and the gerrymandering that will go forward because of the way that the state legislatures went in 2020. And there is obviously a structural advantage in terms of the Senate, because smaller states, they have more representation. Emma likes to cite this multiple times a week, as I do. 40 million more people represented.
No.
It's an important thing to remind people. 40 million more voters voted for the Democrats in the Senate than the Republicans, yet it's 50-50. We could very well be at an inflection point. And so tune in 5 years and we will let you know how it's going. But also, we'll also hope you tune in tomorrow, right?
Please do.
All right, folks. See you then. And for those of you hanging around, Nomi's going to be joining us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I really wanted to ask her, too, just about like those Gallup numbers about declining religiosity over, you know, it's just this steep decline over since the 2000s started. But, you know, we didn't have enough time. It was just a fascinating topic.
There's also a lot of data about really how much self-identified evangelicals actually go to church, which is not as high as you would think.
Yeah,
frankly, I mean, it is in many respects and that data about religiosity is in part about church going. That specific figure about it, like having. Well, look who's back. Nomi is
Hello.
Back from vacation.
I am.
Hello.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Good. How you doing?
I'm feeling wonderful. I'm feeling rested and cleansed. I got sick on vacation, so I feel clean.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, it's a rite of passage. Yes, cleansed. Not intentionally so.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think
all
you
right.
revealed the kind of sickness that you may have had.
Yes. Yeah, that was pretty explicit.
I thought I was very like chill about it.
So Nomi, what's on your show today?
On our show today, the timing of this could not be better. So we have our panel today is Simon Narode, and Lauren Ashcraft, who ran for Congress in New York against Carolyn Maloney this last cycle in New York City. But she is launching a new show. And then before that, we have a great conversation about Amazon and their distribution program, like the impact it has on like the shipping, how logistics, how it affects the world, the cost it has on the environment, the cost it has on people. The author is Jake Wilson. He wrote a book called The Cost of Free Shipping, Amazon and the Global Economy. So that is the show today at 3 p.m. Eastern on YouTube/TheNomiKeyShow and on Twitch/the_NomiKey_show. And of course on Patreon.
You really got that down now.
Did I do it? Did I get it?
The underscore stuff just rolls off the tongue. It's because you're probably so cleansed. I should remind you folks that this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, but you get it free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. It is your support that keeps this show going. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Check in our podcast description and YouTube description for any of those links on the deals that you might get from our sponsors today. And, Matt is not with us today. He is, has gotten his first shot, right?
I think that is the reason, right? That he's getting it today.
Well, check out, Left Reckoning, folks.
Sorry for the HIPAA violation.
Find it on YouTube.
Matt.
What's that?
You don't have to follow that. You're not a doctor.
Sorry for the HIPAA violation.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that.
I think if you're a medical employee.
We're speculating. All right. Let's take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Number is 646-257-3920. I'm not sure we'll have time for calls today, but if you want to take the risk, it's up to you, folks. See you in the fun half.
Since you left me, keep it.